Quick word on today's schedule. Two conferences this morning on A Midsummer Night's Dream, 9 and 11 as usual. Then this afternoon at 4:15, Your Excellency? 4:15. His Excellency will be discussing the Mendelssohn incidental music to Midsummer Night's Dream, one of the great musical compositions of all time. So a little bit of auxiliary information and some beautiful music. So here or upstairs? Two floors up. Okay. So at 4:15, second floor, two floors up, 4:15. And then tonight there is a Fillmore showing. Do come and see it, because it will be a good part of my second lecture tomorrow morning. So if you want to have any idea what I'm talking about, come and see the movie tonight. I won't tell you what it is. That's part of the, I love surprises. So just, it's well worth seeing. Come on by. So that will be tonight at, I'm not sure the time. I think 110 minutes, 105, 110 minutes. So,
say, I think 7:30.
Okay. And that'll also be two floors up. So we've been chewing the last few days on some very substantial medieval meat. What we have now is a kind of dessert, but it is not English trifle. even a fine dessert can be substantial. And there is no doubt that Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream is one of the most delightful creations of the mind of man. It has been enormously popular from the time it first appeared on the stage, probably 1595. It is meant to be a joyous work. We do know it was most likely written for a wedding celebration. There is debate among scholars as to which wedding it was written for, but it appears to have been around 1595. And from that point to this, it has been the source of limitless joy. This is, I call it one of the few perfect works of art I know. There's not a word you could change. There's not a line you could touch. There's not a scene you would move. There's not a character you would question or readapt in any way. I find this absolute perfection, and perfection of a high kind, because even as it gives absolute delight and is that kind of perfect comedy, simultaneously, it has a very serious core. It is dealing with very important questions, but in a lighthearted, entertaining, delightful way. Now, what I want to do in heading into it is talk a bit about the nature of comedy. We're very fortunate in that Aristotle left us a great essay on tragedy, which we have. And so for centuries, it's been possible to talk about the nature of tragedy and have the terms clearly defined for us. Aristotle set it out. It's one of the first great pieces of literary criticism, if you will. Aristotle also wrote a piece on comedy. We've lost it. It's gone. All we have are a couple tiny little fragments of it, meaning that we do not have that common basis of discussion for comedy that exists with tragedy. And as a result, and for a few other reasons that I'll try to make clear this morning, comedy is more difficult to discuss. What exactly is comedy? The range of tragedy, fairly clear. If I mentioned the Monk's Tale yesterday, where he's going to tell us 100 tragedies. Basically, someone of high status who has fallen. Aristotle's definition is much more complicated than that, but nevertheless, we have the sense of what tragedy is. What is comedy? My students always think comedy means jokes. Ha ha, that which makes us laugh. So the first thing I try to make clear to them is that while comedy may certainly do that, And I would doubt if there's ever been a great comedy written that doesn't include humor and cause us to laugh. That's not what comedy is. Ultimately, let's go back to Aristotle. He begins his discourse on tragedy by saying that tragedy is an imitation of an action that is serious and complete in itself with a beginning, a middle, and an end. So that the first thing I would say, and we can apply this to comedy, is that comedy is a structure of action. It's a structure of action. Even a good joke, a well-told joke, a well-designed joke, is a tiny narrative, is a tiny little story. And if it's a good joke, then it also has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But unlike tragedy, which leads to purgation through pity and fear, comedy leads to a sense of delight, renewal, and reinvigoration. It is very simplistic to say, tragedy leaves us shaken, comedy leaves us happy, but there's truth in that. But the ending depends on, again, the path we take from the beginning to the end, where we go and how we end up where we are. So that comedy, again, if defined by its end, needs a beginning and a middle in order to bring us to that happy ending, that delightful ending. What do we know about the dawn of comedy? It's very hard to say. We have a very firm grasp of the history of tragedy, where it began. I talked about it, in fact, 3 years ago in introducing Oedipus Rex. And indeed, we know that comedy begins with the Greeks. I'm just going to do a little, very brief sketch of the history of comedy, because I think it can be instructive and help us to understand the nature of comedy. If tragedy began with the Greeks, began out of religious festivals, then became a full-fledged art form in its own right, still connected with the religious festivals, but a dramatic competition presented in the springtime at the Festival of Dionysus, in which each tragic playwright would write 3 one-act tragedies combined together, and then they would be presented over a series of days, and there would be a winner of that competition, highest honor the city of Athens could accord. We know that. At some point, and we don't know exactly when, that tragic playwright had to add a fourth play. He'd write his 3 tragedies, but then he had to write what was called a satyr play, S-A-T-Y-R. And he had to follow those 3 tragedies with a little one-act comic piece. So you proved that you could master tragedy, but it developed that there had to be this comic afterpiece somehow dealing with the same materials as the serious pieces. You suddenly had to take something from those serious plays, give it a twist, and a bit of a comic turn. The question has been asked, why was this necessary? Where did it come from? I would give a very simple answer. If comedy does anything, comedy always brings us back to earth, back down to earth, back to the here and now. And after the intense emotions, the high intellectual questions, the deep spiritual probing of tragedy, somebody realized before you sent the people back to their homes, you had to return them back down to the here and now and the solidity of earth. And as a result, I suspect, this is another one of White's crackpot theories, it was decided we'll give them a chance to laugh a little bit at what they've just seen, cool them down, relocate them in this theater back in Athens, send them home. They'll still remember those tragedies, but they can once again go about their daily routine. Because comedy is set in the here and now. Comedy at root is social. Is social. If tragedy tends towards the metaphysical, the philosophical, comedy is always social. So we begin with the little satyr play, the little afterpiece. And then, curiously, after the 3 great tragic playwrights in Athens, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, comes a great comic writer, the first of the great comic writers, Aristophanes. And what made Aristophanes a great comic writer, and what we finally had was a whole day devoted to comic plays in Athens, not just a little laughter piece, but a whole day of comedies, and he was the most successful, is that he went on the attack. Aristophanes' comedy from Athens, 5th century BC, is called Old Comedy. And what it means is satire. So the initial comic writer and the first great comic writer basically looked at the society in which he was living, found much to criticize in it, and went on the attack. So that in the course of his writings, we have Aristophanes deeply critical of the Peloponnesian Wars and attacking that in plays such as The Knights and Lysistrata, deeply critical of what he saw as pompous philosophers. He attacks Socrates in the clouds. Socrates is in a basket floating up in the air, a balloon in a basket floating up in the air. There are some who claim Aristophanes may have been responsible for Athens turning against Socrates. I'm not sure we can give him that much credit. Nevertheless, he pokes fun, really goes after Socrates. One of my favorites, rarely performed, called The Wasps, where he goes after the jury system in Athens. The Athenian, part of your duty as an Athenian citizen was to serve on the juries. And it had come to the point where the Athenians didn't particularly want to serve on the juries. And Aristophanes was horrified that the city had begun paying jurors in order to get them and, there and sit on the juries that were giving them money. Aristophanes saw it was an outrage. It showed that Athens was breaking down if you had to pay citizens to do their civic duty. So he writes this play called The Wasps, in which an old man is a jury fanatic. He lives to serve on juries, and his son is so embarrassed by it, he's trying to lock up his father in the house and keep him from going out to serve on the jury, and the father's doing anything he can to get out of the house so he can go serve on the jury again, such as pretending to be smoke and going up the chimney so he can get out that way. So the son finally decides this is just hopeless, so he decides to have a trial at home. And his father can serve on a jury at home and not embarrass him publicly. So they put the family dog on trial for stealing a cheese out of the kitchen. And you have the kitchen implements testifying. It's absolutely wildly imaginative, delightfully funny. Aristophanes' The Birds, two Athenians who get fed up with living in Athens because it's such a crazy place, and therefore go to live the happy, perfect life in the community of the birds. And of course what they do is they end up rebuilding Athens. It's just a complete duplicate, and they become tyrannical. It shows them at the end barbecuing chickens. You know, this is how good they've been to the birds. Anyway, Aristophanes is very funny. The point I'm making, old comedy is social criticism. Okay? And we see this strain continuing down through the centuries. If that's the first, if you will, stream of comedy, it is the notion that there are things wrong in society and I have to correct it by making people laugh at that. And many of the great comedians, the comic writers have done that. Shakespeare's contemporary Ben Jonson is much more in the line of old comedy. He's very harsh. His play Volpone about greed is just savage and ends with harsh punishments for the characters. We think of the kind of harsh comedy, I mentioned last night, George Bernard Shaw's Doctor's Dilemma, his detestation of doctors, and Shaw goes after doctors and just eviscerates them in this play. It's just wonderful. You get a fine comic wit taking on a social target, and it can be funny stuff. All the way up to and including such things in our own time as Monty Python or Saturday Night Live sketches. They're small, they're quick, but again, the basis of it is social criticism. We're attacking society. We have little sketches in which we make fun of whoever the president is. That is old comedy. That is still that straight. Comes from Greece, old comedy. Roman comedy is different. Roman comedy is very different. By the time the theater adapts itself, and the theater was never as popular in Rome as it was in Greece, but it was there, and what was most popular was comedy, but it was transformed, and it's called New Comedy. Old comedy, Greek comedy, 5th century BC, social satire. Roman comedy, about 1st century BC, Roman comedy, romantic comedy. The comedy of young love, the comedy of romance. It's gentle. It's gentle. There may be little touches of social satire, but that's not what the comedy is about. Romantic comedy is about young lovers who are in love and trying to work out things so they can be together. And usually there's some kind of opposition from the parents. Okay. You've got parents standing in the way, or you have some other figure from society. The young girl has been betrothed to an old man and doesn't want to marry him. She's in love with the young man. Okay. We get 6,000 variations on this plot. Play after play after play after play. It's gentle comedy. It is still social, notice. It is still social. But it is not attacking politics, economics, the military. It's looking at the way in which individual desires can be reconciled with the necessity of a functioning social system. If you will, romantic comedy pits the good of the individual against the good of the collective state. That's the tension in romantic comedy. And it makes perfect sense. Aristotle says man is a social animal. It is natural. We tend to live in groups. We tend to have individual desires, individual points of view. We tend to want what we want. And simultaneously, since we live in groups, it is necessary to have rules so we can live together. These two things are often incompatible and cause conflict and tension. And never more so than in that one area where the individual desire is strongest. I love X. I want to marry X. Please let me be happy so I can marry X. And the social group, either parent, guardian, whatever, saying, no, 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 no. You mustn't do that. Wouldn't be good for society as a whole. Okay? That's the basic tension. Now, this sort of thing, again, that's a separate strain. So we have old comedy, new comedy. Social satire, old comedy. Romantic comedy, new comedy. And it goes forward. All Shakespearean comedy is basically new comedy. It comes from Rome. The great playwrights, Plautus and Terence, the two great Roman comic writers, Plautus and Terence. One of Shakespeare's earliest plays, The Comedy of Errors, based on a model by Plautus. He knew the Roman comedies, he adapted them, and that is the basic pattern of most Shakespearean comedy. It's a comedy of romance. Again, this goes all the way through into what we call English Restoration comedy, Sheridan, Goldsmith, She Stoops to Conquer, The Rivals, all the way up to certain modern films. Well, recent films. Now people just blow up and go to bed, blow things up and go to bed together. It's horrible. Within living memory, there were good comic movies. What are called the screwball comedies of the 30s and 40s, Bringing Up Baby, His Girl Friday, something like The Philadelphia Story, if you happen to know that. More recently, Arthur, a very, very funny, comedy, Dudley Moore. And by the way, one other element of romantic comedy, there's almost always the clever servant. There's the clever servant who's there to help his master or mistress achieve the end, and the clever servant is working both sides, okay? Out of this, we get figures such as the comedy of Beaumarchais and the character of Figaro, known from the Mozart opera, Marriage of Figaro and Rossini's Barber of Seville. Clever servant who's there to help the young lovers. In the film Arthur, the clever servant is the old English butler played by Sir John Gielgud, and just an incredible performance. He won an Oscar for it, and he deserved it. He's riotously funny. If you know the wonderful movie called Moonstruck, romantic comedy in the Roman model, the young Italian woman gets engaged and then falls in love with her fiancé's brother. Okay. It can't work out. It's disgrace, you know. By the way, it's also thoroughly Catholic. There's a scene where she's very naughty, and having been naughty, goes instantly to confession. as something you don't often find in modern films. It's a delightful old-fashioned romantic comedy. It's Moonstruck, it's called, and I recommend it to those who have come of age, not young people. That strain is still there, okay? The comedy of romance. That's what Shakespeare is working with. That's what Shakespeare is working with. That is the comedy that he knew. That's where his vision of comedy came from. And one reason that romantic comedy tends to be more often performed than the old comedy is that satire, in some ways, is yesterday's news. Satire has to be current. In order for that kind of comedy to remain funny, it has to be attacking things that are current. Now, obviously, some problems are perpetual. But the fact is, young love is always there. The problems of young love these are ongoing troubles. You always have new young people falling in love, and new young people not quite getting their way and wanting something else, and the parents complaining. It's absolutely standard, and therefore romantic comedy tends to be performed more often. Those are the two strains of comedy. I need to add one other thing. If those are the two structures, if you will, there is one other comic element. And I go back to my original definition that comedy is that which brings us back down to earth. Locates us in time, in space, in our own sphere. This is where I am. This is where I live. Comedy is that which says, don't get too high and mighty. Don't forget who you are. Don't forget that you're flesh and blood and made of dust. Don't get too pompous. For that reason, when jokes appear in comedy and individual moments of insight come in comedy, they are at their funniest when they bring us back down to earth. Let's assume it's winter here, and you're out shoveling around the flagpole. You've had one of those good Minnesota snowstorms. There's a foot and a half of snow out there. And a couple of you are out there shoveling around the flagpole, getting the parking lot clear, and one of your friends and cohorts comes out the chapel door carrying a shovel and two more brooms to help, and hits a patch of ice on the top step, and goes head over tea kettle into the snowbank with shovels and brooms flying. Your second reaction will be to run and make sure that person's okay. We know what your first reaction will be. You just gave it. You just gave it. Does this mean you are insensitive, inhuman, cruel, and heartless? Not at all. Not at all. What it means is, you have just witnessed what I call the fundamental joke. The oldest joke in the world is somebody falling down. It's the reason why from the dawn of time through vaudeville up to the present day and somebody slipping on ice, whether falling on a banana peel or falling on ice, we laugh when we see someone fall down. Because it is physical enactment of what all comedy does at its best, it brings us back down to earth. When we try to get high and mighty, it brings us back down to earth and reminds us of the fact that we are anchored to the earth. Let me take it one step further. Comedy reminds us that part of who we are is animalistic. We are part animal. We have flesh and blood. We're connected to the earth in that way. We're different from the animals, in spite of what my students try to tell me. No, 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 they have their own language. We just don't understand it. I maintain we're different from the animals. But nevertheless, having flesh and blood and being part of this earth, made of dust, we have a connection to them. Now, the animals we know, most of them, the horses, the dogs, the rabbits, go around on four legs. Some claim that our nearest relatives, and I disagree with this too, but nevertheless, for the sake of discussion, the great apes. Okay, go to the zoo and look at the gorilla, and what you'll find, even the gorilla, which resembles some of us in kind, will keep these two These two limbs free, okay? The gorilla may squat down, but still, these things are there for support, should he need it. He basically still has access to four limbs. I love doing this in the classroom when somebody walks by, okay? You know. But man, proud man, as Shakespeare says, stands upright. Two's fine for us. These we can use to scratch our head or, you know, pick our nose or whatever we want to do. These are free for other things. To write Hamlet, doesn't, you know, these, we keep these free, which means, unlike other animal species, we will stand on two legs. Tiny bit of pride, but we are different. We are upright, but occasionally we are reminded that we're still subject to the law of gravity. And it is much easier for a human being to fall down than a horse, because we've only got these two supports under us. So if I'm walking along, hit a patch of ice, boom, down I go. I've been brought down to earth and reminded that I am subject to certain laws of nature, in particular the law of gravity. And as I'm lying there, groaning on the ice, I have to say, oh man, yep, I'm subject to natural laws. I've just been brought back down to earth. I guess I better not be too pompous. And around me, people are giggling. This is the nature of comedy. It's good-humored at best. It's good-humored at best. It's the reason why anything that reminds us we have bodies and those bodies are subject to natural laws will be funny. It's the reason why, as a high school boy, I roared with laughter at The Miller's Tale. Because for adolescent and teenage boys, there's nothing funnier than the passing of gas. Okay? And movies for decades now have been aware of that. It's the reason why the single funniest scene in modern film is in Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles. After 40 years of cowboys sitting around the campfires eating beans, and that includes the great hero John Wayne. John Wayne was never subject to bodily functions of any kind. Mel Brooks puts those same cowboys around the campfire, gives them tin plates filled with beans. They're shoveling beans into their mouths and simultaneously being fully human and lifting their haunches and cutting them one after another. And it's riotously funny because all of a sudden those heroic cowpokes are very real and human like the rest of us. Now, in puritanical America, that scene was considered so offensive they couldn't put it on television. Apparently because nobody in America had ever done that, had never eaten beans, had never had that reaction. That chemical process had never gone inside any American stomach. That may happen in decadent Europe, but not here in America. And therefore, they cut the soundtrack. And they replaced it with burping. And the scene was not funny. You burp when you drink Coca-Cola. When you eat beans, you fart. It's that simple. It's that simple. So that what it teaches us again is that comedy must be true. It must be true. There has to always be some sort of connection between the facts of the world, the way things actually operate in the world, and our recognition and understanding of it. If not, if comedy lies, it is not funny. It is not funny. I go through this again because we are going to find in Midsummer Night's Dream aspects of low comedy. We have here comedy stretching from the very top to the very bottom. Shakespeare is including all of it here. All of it here, and it's a remarkable play for that reason. Quick review. Old comedy satire came from Greece. New comedy, Roman comedy, romantic in nature, and the fundamental nature of the comic vision. We are human, but we are also connected to the earth and subject to certain laws, and when we're reminded of that, and quite literally brought back down to earth, the result is laughter. The result is laughter. And healthy laughter. And healthy laughter. There's really nothing wrong with it. But of course, all things in proportion. Now, Let me compare Midsummer Night's Dream, because we now have a Renaissance play, if you will. Again, written nearly 200 years after the Canterbury Tales. We've moved into a different age. If in Chaucer we have a comic vision, and I would call the Canterbury Tales basically a comic work, certainly not tragic, we have a very different kind of comedy. We have a kind of comedy in Dante and in Chaucer that we must call Catholic comedy. The Greeks could not have conceived of it. The Romans could not have conceived of it. What I mean by that is, in both cases, whether you have Dante the pilgrim traveling through the Inferno, the Purgatorio, the Paradiso, we have something moving toward a triumphant, happy ending, a happy close. And Dante himself called his work La Commedia. He simply called it the comedy. Later generations added the term divina, a divine comedy. But what Dante was underlining in naming his work is that even though it was serious in intent and serious in execution and vision and dealt with profound theological, religious, philosophical questions, he would call it a comedy because the movement of the work is upward toward paradise and the beatific vision, and that is the occasion of great joy. And the fact of the matter is, the Catholic knows that as in one sense our body is part of the earth, our soul comes from God and belongs with God, and we have these two movements. If you will, low comedy bringing us down to earth, but there is a higher comedy of the soul aspiring toward heaven. And that's not tragic. That's not tragic. The Canterbury Tales is a similar kind of comedy. We have the pilgrimage. We may start with the miller playing us out of town, but we're heading again towards that shrine, that cathedral at Canterbury. We're heading towards that beautiful vision of the eternal city, and that's comic in nature because that's a happy ending. That's a glorious ending. That is the proper resting place for the soul, and that is comic. Not in the way I've been describing before. That is not, it may be social in the fact that we're all moving together, all the pilgrims moving together. It may be social in that as Dante travels through hell and purgatory and heaven, he encounters hundreds of souls. We see, if you will, an afterlife populated with souls. So again, there is a social element. But the final vision is the soul of Dante confronting God, as the final vision in the Canterbury Tales is Chaucer asking pardon and retracting that he had done in his early work that's not good. It is the soul before God, but since it's comic, filled with hope, with a sense of hope. Now, A Midsummer Night's Dream is merely comic. It is social in the sense of new comedy. It's romantic. But something happens in it that gives us a touch, just a touch, of something else. But we cannot rank it with the Divine Comedy or the Canterbury Tales. It's of a different order. Not necessarily lesser for that reason, but very, very different. Very, very different. By the way, just as an offshoot, I find it fascinating that kind of high Catholic comedy of Dante and Chaucer vanished for centuries and has only, to my mind, just returned in the 20th century. A work such as Walker Percy's The Moviegoer or the short stories of Flannery O'Connor are comic. Evelyn Waugh's Bride's Head Revisited, a serious novel in many ways, is nevertheless Catholic comedy. It ends with the salvation of souls. And hence, we can't call it tragedy. That is a comic vision. That is a hopeful ending. That is a bright, optimistic ending. How bizarre that in the 20th century, that decadent, fallen, miserable, awful time that's ongoing, that's been bequeathed to us here in the 21st, you have the reemergence of serious comedy by Catholic writers who are again looking at that kind of pilgrimage of souls and the possibility of going to heaven. It's quite remarkable. It's quite remarkable. Finally, I'm getting to Midsummer Night's Dream. Here we are. Let me put it in context. As I said, probably written in 1595, probably written for a high society wedding, although then it immediately went on the stages and was very popular. Shakespeare is still a fairly young man, having arrived recently in London. We don't know for certain. 1590, 91, 92, he comes to London. He's had some measure of success. Comedy of Errors, very popular. Taming of the Shrew. Most successful, the early history plays, Henry VI, parts 1, 2, and 3, and Richard III. He's had a big success with an imitation Roman tragedy called Titus Andronicus, modeled on Seneca, the great Roman tragic playwright. So he's been very successful. He's made a name for himself. But all of a sudden, at about this time, he is having enormous success. He turns out three masterpieces almost simultaneously. A great English history play that goes light years beyond the earlier ones. He writes Richard II, stunning play. He then writes a tragedy you may have heard of called Romeo and Juliet. And then he writes a comedy called A Midsummer Night's Dream, and the three come bang, bang, bang. Perhaps in the space of a year. Perhaps in the space of a year. There is some question about the order in which they were written. I'll say more about that later. I would go to the mat. I would bet the ranch on the order in which they're written, but I'll say more about that later. But the fact of the matter is, he has hit his stride. And from this point on, there's no looking back. It will just be one masterpiece after another. So that he is in total control of this play. He is now a master playwright, knowing exactly what he's doing, and able, something that very few playwrights have ever been able to do, to work within a range of material that's extraordinary. To write Romeo and Juliet in this play and this great English history play in 1 year says he's feeling his oats and he's showing he can do almost anything. Let me reinforce that. Within the space of A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a fairly short play, it's one of his shorter plays, it's not terribly long, which is why it's a wonderful play to be done by junior high school students. It's perfect to have them read, to have them act it out. It's not terribly long. The language is fairly clear. The poetry is magnificent, but the poetry is accessible. It's filled with good humor, delicacy, some low comedy. It's got everything in it. Even though it is short and in its way accessible, it's an incredible piece of work. And what I want to look at first is simply the craftsmanship of this piece. This is so well put together that it's easy to overlook the miraculous nature of what he's done here. Simple little play, delightful comedy, popular stage piece, and he has taken four separate plots and combined them. Just as I said, Chaucer always took the stories from elsewhere. So Shakespeare borrowed his plots, but here he's borrowed four of them, and then countless other sources. I mentioned last night, somewhere between 12 and 24 different sources have been found for this play. Depending on what he was reading, what happened to strike him, boom, he'd toss it in. But nevertheless, we've got four storylines that are working here. Number one, you should be familiar with. The play opens with Duke Theseus. Play opens with Duke Theseus, meaning that the framing device in the city of Athens, where the play begins, is Duke Theseus, who's about to marry Hippolyta. Where are we? What's he working with? The Knight's Tale. Not just in terms of the way in which Theseus is presented, we get some variation. But nevertheless, we're opening with Theseus, who is providing the solid rock, the majesty, the vision of control that the play is going to need. Well, how do we know that he's taken it from the knight's tail? Because he actually lifts some lines from the knight's tail. And there is the great scene in Act 4 where Theseus decides to go hunting. And when he gets out in the woods, what does he discover but the young lovers? Except this time it's the two couples, all of whom are asleep on the ground, having fallen asleep during the night, and the fairies have put things right, if you will. But nevertheless, Theseus wakes up the young lovers and says, what are you doing out here? It's right out of the Knight's Tale. It's right out of the Knight's Tale. Chaucer used it. Shakespeare read the Knight's Tale. Boom, here it is. And we, again, how do we know it? Because the last play he writes, The Two Noble Kinsmen, is based exactly on the Knight's Tale. The end of his career, in a collaboration with John Fletcher, he'll treat the Knight's Tale directly. So number one, Theseus and Hippolyta, taken from the Knight's Tale, but nevertheless, what world are we in? We're in the world of classical mythology. So I think it's fair to say that the framing plot, the first plot, is taken from the world of classical mythology via Chaucer. That's plot number one. What happens there? Theseus has conquered Hippolyta. We'll look at the references. They've come back to Athens. They will be married in 4 days. The play will end with the great wedding celebration. And they simply have to pass the time during those 4 days until they can finally be married. Second, two pairs of young lovers. Demetrius had loved Helena. Hermia has fallen in love with Lysander. Lysander loves Hermia. Helena loves Demetrius. Demetrius sees Hermia. He falls in love with Hermia. Her father, Aegeus, says she must marry Demetrius. Hermia's in love with Lysander. Where are we? Roman comedy. Plain old Roman comedy. We have unhappy young lovers in a difficult situation. The society is demanding that young Hermia marry the man her father wants her to marry, and she's unhappy. Classic Roman comedy. But where's the clever servant? Takes us into the third plot line. The clever servant in this play becomes Robin Goodfellow, Puck, the young fairy, who's in there sort of doing his thing to adjust things for the lovers. But he makes two or three big boo-boos before he finally gets it right. But we sort of have that figure. But Shakespeare now has taken a third plot strain, the story of the fairies. Oberon and Titania, king and queen of the fairies, who are a comic echo, if you will, of Theseus and Hippolyta. We've got the Duke and the Duchess of Athens. We've got the king and the queen of the fairies out in the woods. Yep. And we have love complications there, only mentioned and then dropped, but absolutely absurd. Oberon accuses his fairy queen, Titania, of really being in love with Theseus. And she says, oh yeah, well I know that you're interested in Hippolyta, and they've got other problems as well. Okay, so we have one married couple at the beginning of the play, king and queen of the fairies, and they're having domestic problems. Beyond that, we have the fight over the little Indian page boy, which is there for who knows what reason. It's to add, if you will, to the complication. Titania has seen the little Indian page boy. His mother was a votaress who worked with Titania, and she loves the little boy she wants to keep in. Oberon wants the little boy in his entourage. They're fighting over the kid. It's a plot device. It's what Shakespeare called a MacGuffin. What Alfred Hitchcock called a MacGuffin. That is something in the plot you need to sort of make the plot go, but is of absolutely no importance whatsoever. It's just there. Somebody asked Hitchcock in an interview once, but he's always talking about the MacGuffin. If you know Psycho, the MacGuffin is the money that's stolen. We think it's the center of the plot. It just disappears halfway through, and it's gone. We thought it was about theft. That's not what it's about at all. The battle seems to be over this little page boy. It's not about that at all. We don't hear anything more about him after one point. Hitchcock called it a MacGuffin, and an interviewer said, where's the word come from? And Hitchcock said, two gentlemen are riding on a train, and there's a wrapped package above them. And one says to the other, what's that? And the man says, oh, that's a MacGuffin. The man says, what's a MacGuffin? He says, it's a device to keep lions at a distance. And the man says, lions? There are no lions anywhere in this entire country. And the man says, oh, then that's no MacGuffin. All we can say is that the little page boy is a MacGuffin. Why is he there? Well, it does something for the plot. Anyway, we've got a domestic quarrel for two reasons. Jealousy and the possession of the page boy. And what? We've got the entourage of fairies we will meet. Cobweb and Peas Blossom and Mustard Seed. Just wonderful stuff. And Puck. What world are we in? We're in the world of English folklore. All of this is coming out of English folklore. Finally, plot number four. We've got, they're called the Rude Mechanicals, the workmen, who are going to put on a play in honor of the marriage of the Duke of Athens. I will have much to say about them. Where do they come from? They come out of the Three Stooges. Okay. I mean, it's that timeless world of men hitting each other with boards for no reason. It is that endless world of farce, which I've already spoken about, which is people falling down and it's funny. We are in the realm of the delightfully dumb and pathetically stupid whom we just love laughing at. And as these earnest, serious workmen go about putting on their play, Shakespeare's provided an opportunity for four or five great clowns to simply get out there on the stage and make us laugh. So that where does it come from? It comes from the world of low farce, the world of the banana peel. Okay, the world of somebody slipping on the ice and falling down, which is low physical humor and it's funny. But notice what we've got here. Notice what he's done. This is Shakespeare in full possession of his genius because he's taking a plot from Greek mythology, the outlines of Roman comedy, characters from English folklore, and characters from burlesque, low farce, low comedy, and weaving them all together seamlessly so as we read the play, it seems one thing. What we can say about Shakespeare's imagination at the beginning of his career when it comes full throttle is that it is synthetic. He is able to take these extraordinarily different ideas, categories, characters, plot lines, and put them together and make them whole. And what this play teaches us about Shakespeare and his view of the world is that he had the capacity to see the unity among things that seem to be different, or to bring them together and make them whole. He will do this in play after play, and do it so spectacularly well that we don't see the very precise and deliberate joints. It's like, if these beautiful wooden tables you're sitting at, we could take apart and look at how they have been put together. Whoever the carpenter was that made them had to make individual pieces of wood and then join them together, but we look and see one beautiful table. That's what Shakespeare has done. What are the joints? I'm now just talking, in saying this, I am just talking the ways in which he makes different things one thing. Theseus and Hippolyta relate to the young lovers because Theseus is the duke and rules on who Hermia will marry. That's the connection there. Theseus and Hippolyta relate to the fairies through the jealousy of the king and queen of the fairies for the two humans. And they relate to the Rude Mechanicals. How? By the fact that the Mechanicals are producing a play for their wedding. Every single one of them connects. How do the young lovers connect with the fairies? Man, that's the whole center of the play. They go out in the woods, and the fairies become the means by which eventually this love dance is sorted out and they get the proper partners. How do they connect with the Rude Mechanicals? Because by the end of the play, we're going to have a triple wedding. Not just Theseus and Hippolyta, the other two young couples will be married as well. So the play ends up being presented for three married couples, not just one. and the workmen don't realize, but they are indeed presenting a play for these others as well, and they will become commentators on the play. Theseus and Hippolyta and the two other young couples will sit there and give critical commentary. Everybody's a critic. Will give critical commentary on the play being presented, okay? There's those, and finally, how does the world of the fairies connect with the world of the rude mechanicals? Oh, it's on the cover of every edition of Midsummer Night's Dream ever done. Bottom is transformed, gets the ass's head, and the queen of the fairies, Titania, falls in love with him. What? It's absolute absurdity of a profound order. It's purely Shakespeare's own. It's a riot. It's the center of the play. We'll get there eventually. But right there, oh, I love this. I love this cover. It's repeated over and over and over again. There the two of them are together. It's just wonderful. In any case, point I'm making, he has joined all the plots seamlessly. This is an extraordinary example of dramatic construction. This is before we even get to the play. It's what playwrights now won't even bother to attempt to do. Modern drama, three people sitting in a room waiting for the welfare check to arrive. You know, that's all it is. There's maybe the room won't even be there. Who knows? And there'll be no dialogue. No plot, no characters, no point of nothing. Certainly not delight. Certainly not comic delight in any way. Now, I can fit one last thing in here. I talked about the design of the action, the plots, combining four plots. Let's talk about the setting. Now, Shakespeare, of course, is operating on a bare stage. Beauty of Shakespeare is, we don't necessarily have to go anywhere. We don't have to put up big stage sets. The stage is a bare stage, so he simply tells us where we are. There's no need for elaborate construction. And he will do it baldly and open-facedly. Some of my favorites. As You Like It. Rosalind walks in and says, "So, this is the Forest of Arden." Okay. Okay. We know where we are. In Twelfth Night, Olivia walks in and says, and where am I? And the captain says, "Why, this is Illyria, lady." And she says, "Well, what shall I do in Illyria?" "Oh, I guess we're in Illyria. I don't know where it is, but we're in Illyria." He's open and direct about it. But even if we're on a bare stage and the words tell us where we are, he is using settings, okay? He is using the setting. And here in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Act 1 is set in Athens. Then we go to the woods for Acts 2, 3, and 4. And then at the end of Act 4, we leave the woods and go back to Athens. Couldn't be simpler. We basically have two locations. But notice what he's doing, and it's deliberate, and it's part of the design. We begin in the city. We begin in society. We go into nature, the natural world, and then we return to the social order. And in that progress of settings, we have something about the design, the thematic design of the play. I reiterate, comedy is always social in nature, and the conflict in comedy is a social conflict. So that if we begin in the city of Athens, or begin in any city, you have people living together, and when people live together, there are tensions. There are laws, there are obligations, there are rules. And you must follow them if you're going to be part of that social order. I will come back to that in the next lecture. But at some point, it's very clear that certain individuals will become unhappy with that. And they'll run off to the freedom of the outdoors. Thoreau running off to Walden Pond. All those hippies in the 60s running off to communes and, you know, living out in the countryside and going into the sneaking off to McDonald's once a week to get a Big Mac. But nevertheless, we make our stand. The notion is, and I don't care if it's Thoreau or the hippies in the 60s or Hermia and Lysander in A Midsummer Night's Dream, when I'm fed up with the restrictions of the social order and I want to be free, I'm going to go to nature. Because nature, that natural, the assumption is what? There are no rules. I can live my own life as a free spirit. I can get out in that green world and I can have my own home and make my own rules. That is the idea. The green world, the world of nature, becomes the place of escape, the place that we can go to. Fact of the matter is, not many people know this, but Thoreau about every couple of weeks would leave Walden Pond and go back into the town where his sister-in-law did his laundry for him. Okay? So what we need is we still somehow need to go back. We are dependent on other people. And what Shakespeare tells us here by ending the play in Athens, hey, you want to be married? Marriage is a social contract. Marriage has social roots and ramifications. And therefore, you're going to have to end up going back to that city. You're going to have to return to society. And they all do, but everything's been resolved. It's all been worked out. And the final glorious vision of comedy is, I can have my personal desires, I can have my wishes, I can fulfill my will with the blessing of the group. Compromise is possible. Comedy says to us, compromise is possible, and marriage is the perfect symbol of that for the simple reason I get to have this person who will give me happiness forever, and all of the social world will gather around and approve of it and bless it and have joy in it. Why? Because out of that socially sanctioned union come the future members of society. The future life of the society, because out of marriage comes new life, new children, new growth, regeneration, renewal. I get my personal happiness. The society gets itself renewed and regenerated. How is it possible? The magical fact of the marriage. And Midsummer Night's Dream, if you will, is a triple whammy, because we will end with three marriages, not just one. It's a glorious vision of a very happy ending.